East. Once Dr. O'Donnell returned, Lyra would lose her chance. The girl had waited in the hall. When Lyra emerged, she saw the boy retracing his steps, making a search of the hallway. "I had it right here," he was saying. Another sleepy-looking employee had just come to her office door, blinking and yawning as if she'd just been napping. "Right here, in my pocket." When he looked up and spotted Lyra, he blinked, and Lyra was seized by sudden panic, but his eyes traveled through her down the length of carpet. Of course, he wouldn't think to check her or look in her pockets. They thought she wasn't capable of it. Too dumb to lie, too dumb to plan. Lyra followed the girl back to the empty office, taking a seat quietly as the girl tried and failed to make the key work. She made a face when she saw the gum jamming the lock. "I don't believe it," she said. Suspicion tightened her face. "Did you do this?"
"Do what?"
Lyra asked stupidly. The girl rolled her eyes.
"Worst night ever! Just stay here."
Lyra nodded, dozy as an animal. She counted the girl's footsteps until the carpet had absorbed them completely. She stood up, steadying herself against the wall. She had to be careful, to stay clear of any holes that might grab her. For the moment, the hall was clear. She went quickly, scanning for hiding spots, checking door handles lightly with her fingers, looking for open offices. She ducked into the bathroom again when she heard voices, but the sound of a closing door quieted them. They had gone into an office, whoever they were. She found her way to the stairwell without seeing anyone else. The doors were still propped open by the same book, its pages furred with moisture and age. The first basement level was still dark, still full of the lumpy silhouettes of old equipment. She kept going, listening carefully for footsteps, since the turns concealed the landings beneath her. The girl with the striped hair had probably already discovered she was missing. Lyra had a minute, maybe two, before the girl panicked and launched an all-out search. She reached sub 2, and the gate locked with a keypad. She nearly cried when she saw that it required a numbered code. She'd forgotten all about it. Her palms were sweating and dizziness rose like a sudden swarm of insects. She leaned against the gate, sucking air into lungs that felt like paper. She imagined her whole body strapped with fear and anger. She imagined burning up with it, like the woman who, arriving at Spruce Island, had detonated the dozen homemade explosives lashed to her body. She imagined screaming so that all the windows shattered, so the roof blew off, so that everyone above her was consumed in flame. She imagined fire. She wheeled away from the gate and backtracked up the stairs, leaning heavily on the railing until she spotted what she wanted. On the landing of Sub 1, directly across from the swinging doors, a small red-handled fire alarm. At Haven, the alarms had been enclosed by plastic, surfaces warm and smudgy from the fingers of all the replicas who'd touched them for good luck and connection. "Pull down," the alarm said. She pulled. The noise made her teeth ring. It vibrated her eyeballs. Immediately, the stairs filled with the echoes of distant shouting. She rocketed across the landing and hurtled past the swinging doors into the dark recesses of the empty basement level. From where she stood, she could see a steady flow of people up the stairs from Sub 2, but not Selim. She kept waiting for him to pass, but all she saw were strangers made identical by their confusion, by the quick flash way they passed behind the glass. She counted them all, the way she counted beads of IV fluid from the drip bag. 2, 7, 9, 14, 15, 16. Still, Selim didn't come. The blur of people slowed. She counted 3 heartbeats when no footsteps rattled the landing, when the window stayed empty of passing faces. Hardly thinking, she pushed once again from her hiding place through the swinging doors and hurtled out into the open stairwell. She sprinted down the stairs, no longer thinking of being caught, thinking only of Selim, of reaching him, of losing her chance. As Lyra crashed around the corkscrew of stairs, she saw the gate at the bottom of the stairs was only just swinging closed. She saw the inch of space between lock and gate as a narrow tether. She leapt, shouting, reaching for it the way she might have reached for a rope and got a hand through the gate just before it clicked shut. Her mouth tasted like iron relief, like blood. Beyond the gate was the door marked Secure Area, Live Samples, which she opened with the stolen keycard. It was very cold. For a moment she stood with goosebumps, lifting the hair on her arms, suddenly confused by a vision of Haven unrolling in front of her by the collapse of past and present. But it was just an illusion. This hall looked almost identical to so many hallways at Haven. There were no offices here. There was no carpeting, just a long linoleum hallway and windows overlooking darkened laboratories, doors barred and marked with do not enter signs, cameras winking in the ceiling. Her stomach turned. She'd forgotten all about the glass eyes, and she felt a pull of both homesickness and revulsion. Almost as soon as she started down the hall, a man with an afro and a goatee turned out of one of the laboratories shouting something. She froze, thinking he was angry or that she'd been caught. Then she realized he was just asking her a question. "Is it a drill or what?" he said, and she realized, too, that he had no idea who she was. Dr. O'Donnell had told her there were 150 people who worked at K6. He must simply have mistaken her for one of them. "Not a drill?" she said, and had to repeat herself twice over the noise. "Everybody out! I'm making the rounds," she added, when he started to respond, and she continued past him down the hall. Maybe that was the secret, and why at Haven the doctors and nurses had been able to lie for so long. People were trained to believe. Lyra counted two laboratories, each of them a fraction of the size of Haven's. Some of the pieces of equipment were familiar. She recognized them from the vast, brightly sterile rooms where the doctors had done all the making, had with a shock of electricity made an egg swallow the nucleus, the tight, coiled place where DNA nested, of another person's cells. But K6 didn't make replicas. Dr. O'Donnell had said so herself, and Lyra didn't think it could be a lie. If there were other replicas, Dr. O'Donnell wouldn't be so desperate to use Selim as evidence. Dr. O'Donnell had said K6 helped other places do research, but Lyra hadn't thought to ask what kind of research she meant. Or maybe she had thought to ask. Maybe she had known deep down, and she didn't want to hear the answer. Understanding was like its own kind of alarm, so loud, so overwhelming, that the only choice was to ignore it altogether. There were just three other doors in the hall, and one of them wouldn't open. But the second one did, and inside, she found Selim, sitting on the floor, knees up, head down on his arms. She called his name at the precise moment the alarm was silenced, so her voice echoed in the sudden quiet. "Are you hurt?" she asked. A stupid question. When he stood up and came toward her, his face was pale, and she noticed new cuts and bruises on his cheek. "The guard," was all he said. He didn't hug her, but from a distance of several feet he lifted his hands and touched her face and smiled. "We have to go," he said, and she nodded. But she hesitated when she registered all the industrial freezers, the careful labels and printed signs. The whole room was full of them, storage freezers, of the kind that kept embryos cold on ice until they were ready for use. And suddenly she knew. Who knew eternal life would spring from a cooler in Allentown, Pennsylvania? We give hospitals, facilities, even governments the chance to do their own research. "They're not making replicas," she said. "They're selling them." "They're selling how to make them," Selim said. Lyra remembered what the woman Unju had said to explain how licensing worked. "Let's say I invented a new way to manufacture a chair. They're making new Havens all over the place." He even smiled, but it was a terrible smile, like a new wound. "They're replicating Haven all around the world."
Part 3. Gemma. 22. At almost the same time Gemma fell, Christina and Jeffrey Ives arrived at a Bruinsville, Pennsylvania police station, not 10 miles from the old stone well in the middle of the Sequoia Falls Nature Preserve, where their daughter now lay unconscious. They had arrived in Lancaster County the night before, after one of Jeff's many military contacts, Captain Agrawal, had signaled that Saperstein might have mistaken Gemma and Pete for the replicas they were pursuing, only to discover a calamity. An explosion at the private facility where Saperstein had been licking his wounds and trying, without success, to rally new financial support. Christina refused to consider the possibility that Gemma might be among the dead bodies excavated from the wreckage. She wouldn't even think it. They were ushered by Captain Agrawal down a narrow hallway to the locked and windowless evidence room in the back. Christina had to reach out a hand to steady herself against the file cabinets. How had she ended up in a police station with her daughter missing and children turned to ashes? There seemed to be a gigantic hole in her life that she couldn't bridge. She couldn't remember her way across it. A sudden swoon of terror darkened her vision, made her dizzy on her feet. She imagined they were bringing her inside to show her Gemma's body, still and cold and lifeless, her lips dark as a bruise. Years ago, she and Jeff had refused to accept the death of their only child. They had transgressed the natural order. They had taken their child back after death had already claimed her. She couldn't shake the idea that death had come now to settle the score. When the door opened, and instead she saw Pete Rogers, bloodless and exhausted-looking, and definitely alive, she almost cried out. He was sitting at a table wedged between the metal shelving, which had been cleared of everything but a few cardboard boxes. Or maybe that was all the evidence of crime in this part of Lancaster County. He was gripping a styrofoam cup of what smelled like hot chocolate, and he had a blanket draped around his shoulders. The room was cold and extremely bleak, with a cement floor and exposed wire-encased light bulbs.
"It's the only room that locks, besides the drunk tank," Agrawal said, as if he knew what Christina was thinking. "I wanted to be sure he had privacy."
"Pete!" Christina's relief lasted only a second. Fear grew almost immediately again inside her, a hard, cold metal thing that stuck in her throat. The night before, she'd gone instinctively for the Klonopin in her purse, only to find that suddenly her throat wouldn't work to swallow. She literally could not get the pill down. She hadn't been this sober in years. She hadn't been this afraid either. "Pete!" She went to him and knelt, taking his hands, which were cold, noting the bruised color of his eyelids and the capillaries broken across his cheeks and forehead. "Pete!" He showed no sign of having heard her.
"He's in shock,"
Jeff said, as though it weren't obvious.
"One of the troopers picked him up right on the shoulder of the turnpike a quarter of an hour ago, near the intersection of Route 72.
Agrawal said.
"My guy nearly plowed him."
"He needs a hospital," Christina said. She had a memory of seeing Pete, April, and Gemma laughing together at her birthday party, playing bocce barefoot on the lawn. Pete's pants were rolled to the knees, and Gemma had several paper cocktail umbrellas tucked behind her ear. She was laughing. Could that really have been only 4 days ago?
"We've got a team from Lancaster General on their way now," Agrawal said. "I wanted to bring you in first, in case..."
Christina didn't miss the look Captain Agrawal gave her husband.
"Gemma's still out there."
Pete's voice was so raw it hurt just to hear. It was as if he was speaking through a mouthful of thorns. He started to stand up, lost his balance, and sat down again.
"I lost her. We have to find her."
"Shh." She put a hand on his forehead, which was clammy with sweat. She smoothed back his hair. She had met his mother once, a cheerful, round-faced woman who'd arrived with paint still smudged on one cheek. She was a kindergarten teacher, she'd explained, and Christina had immediately envied her warm, chaotic friendliness. "It's okay. Just tell me what happened." He was grabbing the table as though he still worried he might fall down, even though he was sitting.
"It was Calliope,"
he said, his voice cracking over every syllable.
"She must have had the whole thing planned from the start. Gemma tried to warn me, and I didn't listen. I didn't believe her."
He was shaking. Christina reached out and put a hand on his back, trying to rub some warmth into him.
There was so much blood.
Immediately, it was as if the cold had flowed into her body as well. What do you mean? Memories swept suddenly through her head, brightly awful, like dead leaves. Gemma's veins threaded with tubes and needles, like some kind of alien plant. Gemma's mouth leaking blood the first time she'd lost a tooth. The thick Y-shaped scar across her chest, so similar to the incision that morticians made after death.
There were three of them, Pete said. One of them was just a kid.
What are you talking about? Christina's voice sounded loud in the little room. What's he talking about?
He means those homicides off Hemlock, Agrawal said quietly, avoiding Christina's eyes. She knew that something terrible had happened to one of the Amish families in the area, but she had deliberately tried not to listen. She had enough tragedy of her own. She couldn't handle anyone else's.
He was on the scene.
But Christina had the feeling that there was more, that there was something he wasn't telling her.
I told Gemma to run, Pete said.
He wouldn't look at her. He was staring at his fists, bald now in his lap.
They were coming after her. There was no other choice.
The cold made Christina's fingers and lungs tingle. Who was coming after her? Pete shook his head. It was as if he'd forgotten anyone else was in the room.
They thought she was Calliope, he said. That was the whole point. That was what Calliope wanted.
Christina imagined herself freezing, like a pane of glass webbed with frost, filling with tiny cracks. Who's Calliope? Pete met her eyes, finally.
Calliope's one of Gemma's replicas, he said.
One of... Christina tried to take a step backward and knocked one of the shelving units behind her. There was nowhere to go, no space at all. She couldn't breathe.
All right, that's enough.
Jeff came forward and tried to put a hand on Christina's shoulder, but she jerked away.
The kid is in shock, Christina. He needs to go to the hospital, like you said.
Number 6 through 10,
Pete said, as if he hadn't heard. Now that he was looking at Christina, she wished that he would look away.
5 in all, but Calliope wanted to be human.
He's confused.
Jeff's voice seemed to reach her from a distance, as if she really were hearing him through a thick layer of ice. The air had frozen in her lungs. She couldn't speak. She had the sense that she and Pete were alone at the bottom of a lake, that everyone else, the whole world, was held at bay by thousands of tons of water.
That's why Calliope did it, Pete said in a whisper. She wanted to switch places.
Part 3. Lyra 22. As a cop, Reinhardt knew lies, but he also knew coincidence. Coincidences happen all the time, everywhere. Plenty of rookie cops wasted time giving too much weight to the kind of background coincidence that blew through every life, every death, every case. Coincidences happen everywhere, all the time, but they didn't happen in the same place, at the same time. That was called a pattern. The girl who'd called herself Gemma Ives, that skinny little thing with eyes eating up her face, wasn't any of his business. He had plenty of other cases to worry about, actual cases. 3 other missing persons cases had landed on his desk in the past 6 months alone, 2 of them teenagers from the same low-income district where he'd grown up, 1 of them a 45-year-old stay-at-home mom on the board of her children's PTA, who disappeared in February on her way to the gym. No signs of violence, but no activity on any of her credit cards either. Nothing to indicate whether she was alive or dead. Only yesterday he'd found her in Florida, living with an ex-con who'd retiled her roof last summer. Reinhardt still hadn't figured out a way to tell her husband. As far as he knew, the girl wasn't in any trouble at all. Just because she'd lied about her name didn't mean she'd lied about heading for Pennsylvania to see her doctor. Of course she couldn't have been headed to see Dr. Saperstein, since Dr. Saperstein was dead. It had been all over the morning news. That was coincidence number 1. Maybe she'd lied about his name, too, but it was funny she'd chosen his name in particular. And funny she'd chosen Gemma Ives' name, too, because after Detective Reinhardt had seen the real Gemma Ives' picture, and after he'd Googled around a bit, he found that Jeffrey Ives and Dr. Saperstein, now deceased, knew each other from a place called Haven, a research institute off the coast of Florida. The girl, the skinny big-eyed girl, had said she came from Florida. And if you were counting, which Detective Reinhardt wasn't because it wasn't his business because what did some skinny, desperate stranger matter to him, but if you were, you would count coincidences 2 and 3. And you would know that 3 coincidences were 2 coincidences too many. Of course, anyone could imagine meaningful connections where none existed. It was all a question of wanting. If you wanted to find a thread between JFK's assassination and a UFO sighting in New Mexico, you could be sure you would hit on one eventually. But Detective Reinhardt didn't want to find a thread. He didn't want to see a pattern. He wanted to forget the girl and forget Gemma Ives and the smell of moneyed lies that leaked off her father and the skittish look of his wife like someone awakening in an unfamiliar room from a terrible nightmare. He certainly didn't want to find significance in the presence of federal investigators on a missing persons case. He didn't want to find it strange that they'd grilled him about the girl and her cousin, or whoever he was he'd picked up Sunday night, though Mr. Ives had said previously that Gemma knew no one of her description. He didn't want to find it suspicious that his captain, usually so forthcoming, shut down Reinhardt as soon as he'd thought to question their participation. He didn't want to see, and he didn't want to care. And he sure as shit didn't want to spend Wednesday, his only day off, making the 12-hour drive to Philadelphia. He would have to stop for gas on the way out of Nashville.
Gemma, 23. Gemma blinked into consciousness again, tossed up by a hand of pain. Something screamed, or rather, she screamed, and it screamed, and it was impossible to tell who started first. Leathery wings swept her face and the tangle of her hair, and her voice reached registers she didn't even know she could hit. A high-C horror movie scream that echoed back to her as the bat winged up toward the moon, probably just as scared as she was, knocking against the sides of the well in its effort to get out. It was silhouetted briefly, a black blur against the sky knotty with clouds, and a moon just easing out of the darkness, and then it was gone. And with her terror ebbing, the pain came grinding back instead, and the memory of what had happened, the long, limping escape through the woods, the sudden realization that she was lost. The house in the glen, now, in memory, so obviously abandoned, maybe for a century, and the soft splinter of wood breaking apart beneath her. The well. She was at the bottom of a well, alone, in the middle of the woods. She was shivering. The well smelled, strangely, like the inside of a dirty produce drawer, like the chill of old vegetal rot. The mud was puddled with old water and debris, with a tangle of tree branches and miscellaneous trash. She was lying in the rot of the old well, and when she shifted, she heard the crunch of small animal bones beneath her. High above her, a portion of the well cover was still intact. It blotted out a sweep of sky and reminded her of a half-closed eyelid. "Hello?" she whispered. Of course, no one answered. She cleared her throat and said louder, "Hello?" Her voice rolled off the stones and then dropped. Panic came up from her stomach, sharp-clawed and frantic, like some kind of rodent. She could barely sit up. Her back hurt. Everything hurt. Nothing seemed broken, at least. "Hello?" she tried again. "Help me!" There must be someone out there, someone who would hear. The well tunneled her voice into echoes, so even when her voice began to crack, she was momentarily surrounded by the cascading responses of her own words. "Help me. Help me! Hello? Help!" She shouted over and over into the thin night air, but her voice, still raw from overuse, gave out quickly. It dropped into hoarse croaks and then into whispers. Finally, she couldn't even do that, and when she opened her mouth, nothing came out but a soft whistling, like a leak from a faulty kettle. Still, no help arrived. No one came. No one answered. There was no one around to answer. No one for miles and miles. Only the bats, blind and hungry, clicking their way through the dark.
Lyra 23. There would be no third chance to escape. Maybe Dr. O'Donnell would lock them in cages or cuff them to a bed as some of the replicas at Haven had been cuffed. Or maybe she would simply grow tired of protecting them and hand them over to one of the suits who wanted Lyra and Selim dead.
"You aren't supposed to exist," she had said. "Whose fault is that?" Lyra should have asked.
Every second they delayed brought them closer to disaster, and yet they went through the laboratories, smashing everything they could, knocking equipment from the countertops, shattering microscopes, dumping out chemical samples. Lyra knew Dr. O'Donnell and her staff would recover soon enough. They could buy new equipment, order new chemical samples, but it made her feel better. Every test tube that shattered, every $100,000 piece of lab equipment that crashed and splintered into pieces, seemed as it broke to simultaneously split open a kind of joy inside of her. Finally, there was nothing left to destroy. The hallway carried distant echoes, footsteps overhead, voices shouting words she couldn't make out, people looking for them. They were halfway up the stairs when the rhythm of footsteps narrowed above them. In her head, Lyra saw sound like a cloud that had collapsed into a single dark stream of water. She recognized Dr. O'Donnell's voice and the panicked response of the girl who'd escorted her to the bathroom earlier.
"In here," she whispered to Selim, and she pulled him past the swinging doors into the vacant offices on the basement level.
Through the cutaway window, she saw Dr. O'Donnell pass, followed by the girl and the boy whose ID she'd stolen. There were other employees with them, brown and white and tall and short, but all with the same identical expression of tight-cinched panic. They didn't dare turn on a light, and so they went slowly through the dark space, feeling their way toward an emergency exit sign that floated up through the murk of shadows. More shouts, increasingly urgent, vibrated through the ceiling and floated up through the floor like a dust they disturbed with their feet. It seemed they weren't getting any closer to escape, as if the darkness kept unrolling.
"Wait," she said. She couldn't breathe.
When they reached the emergency exit, a barred door, she was so dizzy she had to stop, leaning heavily against it.
"Wait."
Suddenly she wasn't sure. Dr. O'Donnell was right. There was nowhere for them to go. She wondered how much time she even had left. 1 week? 1 month? 2? Would they spend the rest of her time simply running like this, in the dark, trying to stay ahead of the people who wanted to erase them? And what would happen to Selim once she died? It was terrible to think that he would go on, and terrible to think that he wouldn't.
"We have to go," Selim whispered to her. "They'll find us here."
Lyra still couldn't breathe. The room was spinning, and ideas began losing their shape. Rick was warming soup in the microwave. There were men passing through rows of beds, touching the replicas with their fingers. She recalled the strange, sweet stink that had sometimes carried back to Haven from the ocean when the winds were right and the disposal crews hadn't gone far enough to burn the bodies of the dead. Time, the present, was like a hook. She struggled to hang on.
"Where will we go?" she said.
Selim's breath was hot on her cheek. The dim light of the exit sign gave shape to his shoulders and neck. "Dr. O'Donnell was right. No one can help us."
"It doesn't matter if she's right or not," Selim said.
His hand found hers in the dark. She was shocked by the sense that her heart had traveled down her arm into her palm and that he was holding that instead, fragile and alive.
"She doesn't have the right to say," he said.
"She doesn't have the right to choose." Lyra swallowed. She felt like crying.
"I'm going to die," she whispered.
"Aren't I?" He leaned forward. His lips bumped her nose and then her jaw and finally her lips.
"Sure,"
he said.
"But not yet. Not today."
Elbowing open the door, they found instead of stairs a cavernous loading bay. They ran together, even though the effort made her gasp, and she kept fearing they would hit some obstacle, a sudden wall that would surprise them, although there were dirty bulbs set in the ceiling that switched on with their movement, and she could see there was nothing to stop them. Selim found the switch to control the rolling doors, and the noise rattled her whole body. It seemed to take forever before they'd inched high enough for Selim and Lyra to duck beneath the gap. Either her sickness or her fear began to cut things into clips. A short stretch of pavement and a fence they couldn't climb, dumpsters to their right. To their left, a sweep of red light. A fire truck had come, although as Lyra watched, the lights went dark and the truck began to shimmy itself into a turn. She couldn't see the parking lot or the front gates they'd snuck through. They'd come out the back. They skirted the building looking for other gates or places the fence wasn't reinforced, but the only way out to the street was through the manned gates, and the fire alarm had driven the staff out into the parking lot. There were still a half dozen people milling around in front of the double glass doors. They could wait for the crowd to break up, but that just meant it was even more likely that Dr. O'Donnell would catch up. The only other option was simply run for it, charge straight through the lot and count on surprise. The fire truck was just nosing toward the driveway. They might even be able to hitch a ride out through the gate when they opened it. "Think you can make it?" Selim asked her, and she knew he was thinking what she was. Why stop now? She nodded, although her legs felt wobbly, and she knew that there was always a hole waiting for her, waiting like a long throat to swallow her up. He took her hand again, and she was glad. A sudden strangling fear made her want to cling to him, to tell him that she loved him. But she couldn't make the words come up. They were stuck behind the fear, which glued her lungs and made it hard to breathe. "When I say go," he said, "go." It was a good thing they were holding hands. She wasn't sure her legs would have started moving if he hadn't yanked her forward. They came around the side of the building, charging straight toward the group of people still milling outside, texting, one of them smoking a cigarette, but by the time anyone thought to look up, they were already blowing by the crowd, weaving through the few cars in the lot and sprinting to follow the fire truck as it approached the gate. Everyone was shouting and touching off explosions in her head. The gate was opening to let the fire truck through. They were too slow. They wouldn't make it, but Selim wouldn't let go of her hand. Almost there. The truck had slowed to maneuver through the gates. They were 10 feet away, then closer. They were going to make it. "Stop! Stop! Stop!" Dr. O'Donnell's voice was high and clear. It rang out like a bell. The fire truck braked abruptly, and Selim threw out a hand to keep from cracking into the bumper. One of the firefighters leaned out the driver's side door and cranked around to see what all the noise was. Lyra saw his mouth moving, saw the way his eyes darkened when they landed on her. "Stop!" Lyra was screaming too, or she thought she was. Then she realized she had only been screaming in her head. She threw her voice as hard as she could, hurled it like a stone. "Stop! Please! Help!" He retreated, yanking the door shut. She didn't know if he'd heard. The fire truck jerked forward another few feet. And that did it. Lyra gave up. She dropped. Her knees gave out and she stumbled. Selim caught her and tried to draw her in another direction toward the parking lot, but she could barely stay on her feet. She was too tired. Of running. Of hiding. Of hitting walls. Of finding that every face concealed the sharp set of hungry teeth. Then, Dr. O'Donnell threw herself between them and the truck. "Wait!" she said. Her hair was slicked by sweat to her forehead. "Just wait a second, okay?" Selim had to put an arm around Lyra's waist just to haul her backward. Her feet had stopped obeying her. Her whole body felt as if it were as flimsy, as weightless and useless as an empty sheath of skin. But Selim wouldn't give up. "Come on, Lyra. Come on! Move!" He was still shouting, although it was suddenly very quiet. And then, with a start, she realized why. The fire truck's engine had stopped growling. No more exhaust plumed from its tailpipe, and almost as soon as she noticed, the door opened again, and the firefighter dropped to the pavement from the cab. Another one followed, a woman, this time from the passenger side. Both of them wore heavy rubber suits that made funny squirting noises when they walked. That was how quiet it was. "Is there a problem?" The firefighter who'd been driving had sharp eyes placed very close together, as if they'd been made that way just to notice every detail. "Please!" was all Lyra could say. She was still winded, still gasping for breath, partly from the run, partly from a dizzying sense of relief. Dr. O'Donnell pivoted neatly to face him. There's no problem. In an instant, she transformed. She had been begging them to listen, begging them to stop. But in a split second, she shimmied into a new skin, and Lyra was seized by a sense of dread. I'm sorry you had to come all the way out here. Honestly, we didn't expect them to react like this. He looked from Dr. O'Donnell to Lyra and Selim and back again. What do you mean, react?
They're patient volunteers, Dr. O'Donnell said smoothly.
She's lying, Selim burst out. But Dr. O'Donnell didn't miss a beat.
Sometimes our volunteers get anxious. Sometimes they get paranoid. It's the first time anyone's ever tried to stage an escape, though.
She slid over the words as if she'd been waiting for years to use them, and Lyra hated her so violently, the hatred blew her apart into a thousand pieces. Because the worst part, the absolute worst part, was that Dr. O'Donnell truly believed she was good. She was surprised that Lyra and Selim weren't grateful, that they didn't see the way she wanted to use them as a kind of gift. Because deep down she thought, of course, they didn't deserve it. Because she thought that it was obvious they didn't. And that made her worse, even than Dr. Saperstein. Saperstein had treated the replicas like objects, but at least he never pretended. Dr. O'Donnell thought the replicas should love her for helping them pretend that they were worth something when it was so obvious they weren't. The woman's coat was folded down at the waist. She thumbed her suspenders. So it's some kind of medical research? Dr. O'Donnell smiled. Lyra couldn't believe she'd ever loved that smile.
That's exactly right, she said. Medical research, pharmaceutical testing, all voluntary, obviously.
She's lying. Lyra could finally breathe, but the effort of speaking, of trying to be believed, made her words come in hard little bursts. She's been keeping us locked up. She won't let us go.
Then, you can't believe her.
Dr. O'Donnell didn't even glance at Lyra.
Paranoia, like I said.
The firefighters exchanged a look.
They seem pretty upset, the man said doubtfully, but Lyra could tell he was wavering.
Of course they're upset. They're having a bad reaction to a new SSRI.
Dr. O'Donnell grew taller, swelled by her lies, or maybe the world shrank around her. She sounded calm. She looked calm. Lyra couldn't imagine what she and Selim looked like.
And I can't help them unless we get them inside. They should be monitored. We should be watching their heart rates.
Lyra saw at once that Dr. O'Donnell had won. She watched the firefighters tip over into belief. She saw them shake off their doubts like a kind of irritant.
Please. Selim tried again, but his voice broke, and Lyra knew that he, too, had seen.
Thank you for coming out here, Dr. O'Donnell said. We really appreciate it.
The firefighters had already turned back to their truck. Though they were only a few feet away, Lyra saw them as though from the bottom of a pit, as if they had already vanished into a memory.
Wait! She cried out from the bottom of a long tunnel of anger and fear.
Wait! She said again, as both of them turned back to face her.
Dr. O'Donnell showed her irritation, but only briefly. She was busy playing a role.
Really, we should get them inside.
She said she would let me call my mom, Lyra blurted out.
Selim tensed.
But Dr. O'Donnell looked at her with blunted astonishment. It was as if her polish was only a mask and someone had elbowed it off.
She promised, Lyra said, feeling her way into the lie.
If Dr. O'Donnell was going to make up a story, Lyra could get in there, could hook her hands around it and make it hers.
She said I'd be able to call if I got scared.
Dr. O'Donnell lifted her lips.
I never...
But this time, the firefighters were on Lyra's side.
Oh, for God's sake, let the kid call her mom, the man said.
For a half second, Dr. O'Donnell and Lyra locked eyes. Dr. O'Donnell squinted as if they were separated by a hard fog, and Lyra wondered what she saw. That Lyra was small and young, that she was stupid, that she was dying. Just like Calliope all those years ago and the bird. It was broken, she'd said. It's better to kill it. For weeks afterward, Lyra had dreamed of the bird coming back to life, but enormous and swooping down through the dorms to peck their eyes out one by one.
Dr. O'Donnell even looked vaguely amused. Of course she knew that Lyra had no mother. Of course she knew or thought she knew that Lyra had no one to call. Maybe that was why she didn't put up more of a fight. She shrugged. Okay, she said. She took her phone out of her pocket, and after punching in her code, passed it wordlessly to Lyra. She'd been trained to memorize number series, of course, so that the doctors at Haven would be able to collect data points, would be able to track how quickly her mind was breaking up, and she'd been trained to observe, too, not intentionally, but she had been trained. And in the real world, she'd been trained to lie. Lyra pressed the numbers very slowly, making sure she got them right. Now Dr. O'Donnell was frowning. Honestly, this isn't standard. But the firefighter said nothing and stood there watching. Lyra brought the phone to her ear. She pressed it hard, the way she had with those seashells Cassiopeia had collected long ago, and her breath hitched. It was ringing. Once. Twice. Answer, she thought. Answer. Dr. O'Donnell lost patience. A muscle near her lips twitched. Okay, that's enough. Wait, Lyra said. Her heart was beating so loudly she lost track of the number of rings. Answer. And then a fumbling sound and a cough announced him. Reinhardt. His voice sounded rough, but also comforting like sand. She closed her eyes and watched his name float up from the darkness, resolving slowly like a distant star captured by a telescope. Detective Kevin Reinhardt, hello, she said. Her throat was tight. It was painful to speak. When she opened her eyes again, Dr. O'Donnell was staring at her, shocked, hands hanging at her sides, limp like old balloons. You picked me up in Nashville. You gave me your number and told me to call if I ever needed help. It seemed that everyone was frozen. Selim, watching her, and the firefighters watching her, and Dr. O'Donnell slack-faced and dumb. Only the insects sang, a noise that sounded to her like a motor. She took a deep breath. She had never been taught how to pray, but she did pray then, without ever having learned it. I need your help, she said.
Gemma, 24. In the curdled light of a new dawn, while 100 police officers from all over the state began to gather in the parking lot outside the Bruinsville police station to smoke cigarettes and drink coffee and blink the sleep out of their eyes, while 4 bloodhounds lashed to the wrist of their handler sniffed experimentally at shoes and car tires and the crushed remnants of someone's dropped bacon, egg, and cheese, Gemma woke up to the pressure of a light rain that had started hours earlier, and to a voice calling softly to her. She blinked. Rain blurred her vision, and she swiped it from her eyes, disappointed when she realized that the voice, and her name, must have been part of a dream. There was no one above her, no one looking down on her at all, just the sky, a small and narrow mouth graying above her. Staring up at the knit of clouds, she thought of the surface of a distant mirror. A shadow moved. She saw her own reflection peering down at her as she peered up at it. She blinked again through the long tunnel of rain. Calliope.
Hello, Gemma,
Calliope said. Then Gemma knew that hers was the voice she had heard calling softly to her in her sleep. It took Gemma a long time to sit up. An eternity to claw inch by inch to her feet.
Calliope?
Her voice was dry. She opened it to the rain.
Please, help me.
Calliope's face was a small, shifting pattern of shadows.
Don't be afraid,
she said in a sweet voice, like the subtle pressure of a razor on Gemma's skin. Be a brave girl now. Calliope disappeared again. When Gemma opened her mouth, when she screamed, she felt as if more fear flooded in, instead of being expelled.
Please!
Calliope reappeared almost immediately, and Gemma felt a small flicker of hope. Calliope had murdered all those people. Calliope was sick. She was evil. But she was still someone. She was a chance. Gemma couldn't stand to be alone. She couldn't bear it.
Please, Calliope. She licked her lips. I want to help you. If you get me out of here, you can come and live with me. We can be like sisters.
Sisters? Calliope repeated the word in a puzzled tone of voice.
Like friends,
Gemma said desperately, realizing Calliope likely didn't know what sisters were.
Like best friends who share everything.
For a long time, Calliope looked at her. She seemed to be considering it. Gemma allowed herself to hope. Then Calliope said,
I'm tired of sharing.
This time, when she vanished from the lip of the well, Gemma heard almost immediately the scrape of something heavy on the ground, and then a portion of the sky above turned black. Gemma thought, confusedly, of an eclipse.
Goodbye, Gemma.
Calliope was invisible, hidden somewhere behind the curtain of black that began to inch slowly across the opening of the well. A door, or some kind of table. Calliope must have found it in one of the old cabins. She was using it to cover the well. She was using it to seal Gemma inside. Terror turned Gemma inside out.
No!
She pounded the walls with her fists, as inch by inch the daylight narrowed to a finger, to a line, to a single point above her.
No! Please! No!
The covering slid into place. Now she could see nothing but a faint gray web of a sky, where gaps in the planks revealed razor-thin slices of daylight. Calliope's voice, when she spoke, was so faint Gemma couldn't be sure, afterward, that she hadn't imagined it.
Goodbye.
Gemma screamed for hours. She screamed again and again, calling for Calliope, calling for someone to help. But no one answered. Only the rain, scissoring through the rot of old plywood, the quiet shushing. She slept again. She woke up crying from a dream of rescuers, of friendly voices drawing closer. Wishful thinking, like people who saw mirages of floating water in the desert. But then, once again, she heard them. She sat up as quietly as she could, as if by making too much noise she would frighten off the distant voices. And for a second, she thought she had. She couldn't hear them anymore, and she strained so hard to listen that she felt the effort traveling all the way through her jaw. Then they came again, nearer this time. She could make out only a few phrases, which carried through the woods, and, like water going off a cliff, tumbled down into the well.
Clear. No sign. Radio.
Cops. So someone had been sent to find her. In all likelihood, that meant Pete had escaped and found help. She was saved.
Down here!
She yelled, and was horrified when instead what came out was a fragmented whisper, like the rough sound of dry leaves skittering in the wind. She could barely hear it over the drumming of her heartbeat. She cleared her throat and tried again.
Help me! Please! I'm down here!
A whisper, a croak, a fish opening and closing its mouth soundlessly beneath the water. She'd screamed for hours. She'd screamed herself hoarse. Already the cops were drifting away. Their words lost shape and edge, and their voices became tones, low notes of regret and disappointment. She grabbed a piece of wood from the splintered pile next to her and tried to beat it against the stone, but it crumbled moistly in her hand.
Help me. Please. Please.
She crawled, digging a hand into the loam of rot at the bottom of the well, until she found a rock. Loosing it from the mud, she drove it hard against the side of the well, again and again, rhythmically, and the sound traveled as a shock from her wrist to her elbow and up to her teeth. But it was too late. She was alone again.
Lyra, 24. For a short time, the firefighters waited with them on the road, pacing in the quiet and talking into their radios, casting cautious glances at Lyra and Selim from a distance, as if they were fish and too much attention would cause them to startle away. Then a cop arrived to replace them, a woman with a high forehead and a long nose that reminded Lyra of a hanging fruit. She wanted to talk, to understand, to hear Lyra's side of the story. But though the woman was kind to her, and though Lyra liked the look of her face and the slope of her nose, she didn't want to talk to anyone but Detective Kevin Reinhardt. She didn't even want to get into the police car. She was tired of strangers and their doors. So instead, she and Selim sat on the curb, with the police car parked a dozen feet away, watching the last trickle of car traffic out of K6. Dr. O'Donnell and the other K6 employees weren't in trouble, exactly, because the trouble couldn't be reported or understood when neither Selim nor Lyra would talk, as the policewoman explained to them more than once. But they weren't exactly not in trouble either. K6 wasn't invisible anymore. She kept her hands in her pockets, touching the drift of words, notes, telephone numbers. Proof. And so the employees who had lingered to work late, or to catch a glimpse of Lyra and Selim, spilled into their cars and flooded the exit gates and tried to vanish. Lyra thought of cockroaches flooding from a clogged drain. She tried to pick out Dr. O'Donnell's car in the 60 or so that passed, but the cars looked the same, and the drivers inside of them looked the same too, hunched shadows leaning over the steering wheels as if that would make them go faster, as if they could escape whatever was coming just by leaning forward. He arrived an hour or so before sunrise when the darkness was like a scowl that had folded deep into itself. They waited for him in the car while he spoke to the policewoman who had by then sat with him for hours. It was hot. An empty cup of coffee in the cup holder had scented the whole car with hazelnut. Finally, he returned and put the car in drive without saying anything except, "I brought you snacks." At Lyra's feet was a bag of gas station food and water. Selim ate 3 bags of beef jerky, and Lyra drank 2 bottles of water. Then Detective Reinhardt said, "Do you want to tell me your real name, at least?" Inexplicably, the question, how kind it was, how gentle, and how difficult it was to answer, made tears come to Lyra's eyes. "Which one?" She turned to the window, swiping her tears away with a palm. "I've had 3 so far." And then, after hours of silence, after years of it, she talked. Detective Reinhardt was listening quietly, not saying anything, not interrupting to ask questions, just listening. She told him everything. Haven, all the replicas, Jake Witz, Nurse Emily Huang, Gemma Ives, and how she'd saved them. Dr. O'Donnell and K6, a world full of places where people could be manufactured like furniture for different uses, about Rick Harless, her real father, and the people who'd taken him away. Afterward, he was quiet for a long time. Lyra couldn't tell whether he believed her and was too tired to ask. When he finally asked a question, it wasn't the one she expected. "Do you have any idea where Gemma might be?" Lyra shook her head. "I heard that she was missing." "Missing," he said. He appeared to be choosing his words carefully. "And in quite a bit of trouble." Selim spoke up for the first time. "What kind of trouble?" Detective Reinhardt appeared to be chewing the words. Lyra liked that about him. Too many people used words without thinking. "I'm out of my element here," he said finally. "I'm flying blind." "What kind of trouble?" Selim repeated. "The Lancaster County Sheriff's Office is looking for Gemma," he said with some difficulty. "I got a call about an hour before we talked, because you'd given me her name," he added and sighed. "Funny coincidence." Lyra looked down at her hands. "It was the only name I could think of." "Then, Gemma's my friend." "That's what the Sheriff's Department figured, too. They thought you might be a clue." "A clue to what?" Detective Reinhardt hesitated. "Several people were hurt, badly." He cleared his throat. "They were killed. There was a witness. He described a girl Gemma's age, matching her description." "It wasn't her," Selim said and leaned back. The witness got a good look at her, Detective Reinhardt said. He was very specific and... He broke off. Now his whole face corked around his mouth like there was a wrestling match between them. And what? He shook his head. She noticed then how tightly he was holding the wheel. Dr. Saperstein and the Ives family have history. A long history. Because of Haven, Lyra said. Okay, he exhaled. Okay, because of Haven. He didn't believe her, not totally, not all the way, but he didn't disbelieve her either. Dr. Saperstein was found not far away from where the victims were discovered, and the Iveses are there now in Lancaster. They drove straight from Nashville. Look, like I said, I'm flying blind. He held up a hand as if Lyra had argued with him. But where there's smoke, there's fire. But Gemma wouldn't hurt anybody, Lyra said. She couldn't. He shook his head. Sometimes people can do a good job of hiding who they really are, he said, as if Lyra didn't know that. Some people put on their faces the way you and I put on clothes. Exactly. She was growing impatient. The faces don't mean anything. But when he glanced at her, puzzled, she could tell she'd misread him. He didn't understand. He had listened to her without really absorbing it. Maybe he thought she was making it up. It's like you said. People can wear different faces, and different people can wear the same face, too. It's not Gemma, she repeated a little louder. So it must be one of the others. One of the others. Detective Reinhardt's voice cracked. Yeah, I already told you. She pivoted in her seat to look at Selim. At K6, Dr. O'Donnell said some of the other replicas might have escaped. Wherever Dr. Saperstein was, they couldn't have been far off. Detective Reinhardt was quiet for a bit. So you're saying that Gemma Ives has replicas? That she was... cloned? Of course. Lyra was too tired to be polite. Were you even listening? I just... He broke off. Bear with me, okay? It's a lot. He took a hand off the wheel to rub his temples. So you think one of Gemma's replicas is responsible? I know it, she said. She leaned back against the headrest. She thought of Calliope number 7 squatting to nudge the broken bird with a knuckle before straightening up to smash it beneath her shoe. Lyra had thought at first she intended to help it fly again. I bet I know which one, too.
Gemma. 25. She watched the rain bead along the fine prism of a spider's web. The spider, black-bodied with furred white and black legs, had been at it for hours, leaping and soaring beneath the splintered remains of 2 shattered boards, trying to restore what had been lost when Gemma had fallen. It was amazing how pretty the web looked in the rain, in the trickle of light that reached her down here. She lay there, cheek pressed to the mud, breathing in the smell of rotted wood and leaf rot, surprised that she wasn't afraid, wasn't in pain, wasn't feeling much of anything. She was content simply to watch the spider. She wondered how many times over the spider had seen its own web destroyed, and how many times it had simply begun to reweave. 10, 20, 100? She wondered if Pete was okay, and if he'd made it back to civilization, whatever that meant. She wondered if he'd managed to convince anyone of the truth, or whether he'd been shunted off into some psychiatric hospital. She had no idea what time it was, only that it had been hours since the voices had gone, and so far they hadn't come back. In Chapel Hill, her classmates would be drinking bad coffee in the cafeteria, finishing last-minute homework assignments, sweating through pop quizzes, ducking outside to smoke weed behind the music building. She had to get up. Her stomach hurt. She had to use the bathroom. There was a bad smell permeating the air. She realized that it was coming from the filthy cloth still tightly wrapped around her hand. She had to get out of the well. Not tomorrow, not when, or if someone found her. Now, today. She kicked through the rubble at the bottom of the well. Wood splinters. A soda can. That got her interest. That was good. It meant there were other people who came this way, hikers or picnickers, and she couldn't be that far from help. She found a textbook, too, from someone's history class. The pages warped, the type blurry, and mostly indecisive.